Welcome to this first lecture in the Cold War Studies Center, America as Another Country series. We did organize a lecture or debate last week on the new biography of Mao by Yung Chang and John Halliday, but this in fact is the first in our series on America as Another Country. And what we'll be doing through this series of lectures this term and next, we'll be exploring some of the many complexities of the United States, its history, domestic politics, and its relations with the rest of the world. And I think most of us here would agree there couldn't be a more important or vital subject. The significance, it is often said, of September the 11th was not who committed the atrocity, but who was attacked. And who was attacked, of course, and what gave great significance, therefore, to 9/11 was the United States itself. And since the September the 11th attack, we've seen a huge transformation in America's projection and of power and foreign policy. We've witnessed and experienced two wars, both of which are still going on in Afghanistan and Iraq. We've seen a more assertive posture by the United States, which some have even characterized as imperialism. And we've seen the American president himself declaring at least three states to be members of an axis of evil. We live, as the Chinese would say, in interesting times. And I'm delighted, therefore, to invite two, I think, extremely interesting speakers to reflect on that in the debate tonight on American power, global sheriff, or international outlaw. I'll let you guess who's going to speak for the outlaw and who's going to speak for the sheriff. If you don't get it at the end, well, we'll come back to that in the Q&A. Firstly, I'd like to welcome my old friend, Professor Bill Walforth from Dartmouth College, the United States of America. Bill is here as a visiting professor at the London School of Economics. Bill has written on many, many topics: the history of the Cold War, how the Cold War ended, international relations theories, and many, many more. And Bill will be beginning the debate this evening. Again, I'll let him decide whether he thinks it's sheriff or outlaw, to be followed after 20 minutes by Professor Paul Rogers, professor at Bradford at the Peace Studies Center there. Paul has written many, many works on American foreign policy, on the current world order. And for those who subscribe to Open Democracy, and I'm supposed to give a plug for Open Democracy tonight, you'll often find Paul Rogers reflecting wisely on the world as is and maybe should be. Paul, unfortunately, his new book is not out until 2 weeks' time, so you can't buy it this evening. We've actually become the best sellers of books in London, by the way, recently. But it will be out in 2 weeks' time, called Iraq and the War on Terror, published by I.B. Taurus. So with no further ado, I'll call on Bill Walforth to start off the debate this evening: American power, global sheriff, or international outlaw. Bill, over to you. Thanks so much.
Well, thank you all for coming tonight. I know it's not because, at least I won't speak for my colleague, but it's not, certainly not my famous name that brings you into this room. It's probably the importance of the subject, as Mick says. I want to thank the Cold War Studies Center for providing me with a comfortable, intellectually warm home while I'm here at the LSE. And I guess I want to thank you, Mick, for calling on me to do this talk while George Bush is president of the United States, while American popularity in the world is at an all-time low. You know, when the Cold War was ending and the Eastern Europeans were celebrating liberation that was supported by the United States, you didn't call me for a debate like this. When the U.S. was intervening even in Bosnia and Kosovo, to the applause of those Europeans who had hoped for such intervention, no call from you.
Didn't need you then.
After 9/11. After 9/11, the world rallying to the U.S. side, even supporting the invasion of Afghanistan, silence on the phone from Mick Cox. But as soon as we have Guantanamo, Abu Ghraib, Lindy England, Fallujah, now you call me. Thanks a lot.
Okay.
I appreciate it. Now I have, I have 5 points to make in my 20 minutes, and I'm just going to run through them. They all get, of course, directly at this subject matter, and in a way they all get at the points I was trying to raise there with my interrogation of Mick here, which is, In thinking about this question of whether the United States is an outlaw or a sheriff, we need to look broader than just the question of Iraq, which I think most people in this room will agree is a tragedy, mainly for the Iraqi people, but also for the American people. I have 5 points to make in my 20 minutes. The first point is this. The U.S. is not an international outlaw. Maybe I can just leave. The U.S., if you look at the studies by international lawyers, the compliance rate of the United States with the international treaties to which it's a party is very, very high, higher than many states. When the United States is agreed to a treaty, it generally complies with it. The accusation that the United States is an outlaw focuses on cases where the United States is resisting new international conventions, such as the International Criminal Court, Kyoto, the Landmine Convention, etc. Now, this resistance on the part of the United States cannot be treated as a violation, as outlaw behavior, because international conventions only bind states which accept those conventions. So a lot of people in this room may support those conventions like Kyoto and the ICC. And if that's the case, then you have a political difference with the United States. You disagree over the wisdom of those treaties. But that's not the same as saying the United States is an international outlaw. In fact, there's a fascinating, important, fateful debate underway in the world over the direction of international law. Where should it go? At stake are questions over how to create an international legal regime that accommodates a world with mass terror, and that accommodates the desire on the part of the international community sometimes to intervene in countries to prevent genocide and mass killing. And the law as it stands on these questions is confused, ambiguous, conflicted, and sometimes out of date. So it's hardly surprising that governments of states argue over these laws. Now, I don't support the position the United States has taken on many of these questions. I don't think the United States took a wise, even a politically wise, not to say a morally correct decision, when it decided that detainees it has in its custody that it accuses of being terrorists are not subject to the Geneva Conventions. I don't support that position. Maybe you don't support that position. But we have to agree that the question of whether a Geneva Convention, written for a world in which combatants were all clearly associated with a state government, that that convention might be out of date, and that we might have a rational, reasonable people might have an argument about that convention. So my views as to where international law might go might be hardly different than those of Professor Rogers. We may have a debate about that. But the question of how and where to move the international legal regime, ladies and gentlemen, that's not the question we're debating tonight. We're debating whether the U.S. is an international outlaw. And if the U.S. disagrees with new conventions, that does not make it an outlaw. We can't confuse a debate over where international law should go with the question of whether the United States is an international outlaw. To call someone you disagree with an outlaw is not only not accurate, but it's counterproductive. So I would argue it's not an outlaw. Is it a sheriff? Well, that brings me to my second point. Yes, I would say. It is, kind of. I mean, sort of. In the sense of sometimes acting in at least putting itself forward as to act to preserve the general peace. But it's not a sheriff in the sense of always acting alone. Rather, I would say that its sheriff-like duties, the duties it performs that are like the duties of a sheriff, are part of a general trend in the world toward greater international intervention, not just the United States, but around the world, and that its actions are very often in response to widespread demands on the part of other governments. Now, if you look at U.S. behavior in its sort of sheriff-type capacity, wearing its sheriff hat, whatever that looks like, or its sheriff badge, you can see these as partly passive or background duties, such as when the United States tries to make countries more secure so they won't, in their insecurity, create general international security problems. An example of this is the U.S. Security Treaty with Japan. Here's a treaty that was strengthened in 1995, and one of its implications is to make Japan more secure, reducing its incentives to do things like purchase nuclear weapons or engage in a military buildup. And by so doing, this treaty dampens the threat that China feels from Japan and reduces the possibility of a China-Japan arms race. That's an example of the kind of background security provision that the United States does. But of course, you're probably not here tonight because you're either super happy or super mad about that kind of behavior. It's the active sheriff-like duties, I think, that maybe has attracted most attention. Military interventions, gunboat diplomacy, sanctions over on regimes all around the world. This kind of behavior is what people are generally talking about. Perhaps of all that nexus of activist behavior, the most noticeable is the military interventions. Let's think about those military interventions since 1992. What have you had? You've had Bosnia, East Timor, Haiti, Kosovo, Somalia, Afghanistan, Iraq. Now, these interventions are part of a general trend in international politics, of which you're, I'm sure, aware, towards a greater proclivity of the international community to intervene to prevent or resolve international and civil wars, as well as to intervene to prevent potential genocides or other kinds of mass killing. There's been a huge increase in UN, NATO, EU, African Union, and yes, US interventionism on these grounds. And very frequently, in fact, in most cases, the US has worked together with these various multilateral organizations in most of these interventions. Or, to put it differently, the interventions of the interventions I mentioned, the Bosnia, Haiti, Kosovo, and Afghan interventions, were all undertaken with fairly strong international support, not least here in Europe. So I would argue that the U.S. is not an outlaw, and it's kind of a sheriff, and it's a sheriff, though not always alone. It's a sheriff that is often acting in concert with members of the international community. Which brings me to my third argument, my third point, that this arrangement that I'm talking about, with the U.S. as a sometimes unpopular sheriff and a world that is more inclined towards interventionism, this arrangement, though imperfect, has been a success. That's right, a success. Back away for a minute from Iraq, look at the big trends. It's been successful. Now, scholars have been studying this stuff for years, but I was delighted to see that it now came out in a report by the Human Security Center here in the UK on general trends in international and civil violence. I don't know how many people follow these things, but it's not generally reported. All of these forms of violence are dramatically down since the end of the Cold War. International war, civil war, genocide, all down. All down big time. The number of armed conflicts around the world has declined over 40% since 1991. Genocides, mass killings, down 80%. Arms transfers, you know all about the nefarious, horrible arms trade. It's down 35% since 1991. You know about the global militarization of the world. Defense spending, global defense spending, down since 1990. And not only are the numbers down, but the lethality is down, in that each episode of violence kills fewer people than they did 15 or 20 years ago. This is a general trend of the declining international violence. Doesn't get a lot of news, however, it's true. Now, why is it true? Well, there's several reasons, some of which have very little to do with the United States. One reason is the end of the Cold War. This is the Cold War Studies Center-sponsored lecture. Let's not get nostalgic about the Cold War. That was a system where two superpowers stoked and fueled conflicts all around the world. Little wonder they were so deadly. It's gone. Of course, the United States played, I think, something of a role in ending the Cold War, but clearly it wasn't the primary mover of the end of the Cold War. The report also cites another cause, the spread of democracy. Again, the United States can hardly claim a lot of credit for spreading democracy, but it's one of the things the United States has worked for. But the most important cause of the decline in the most deadliest kind of violence, and the most deadly kind of violence, are civil wars and genocides, not international wars. The most important reason for that decline, according to this report, is precisely that interventionism that I just told you about. Namely, the greater propensity of the international community, sometimes with the United States leading, sometimes with the United States supporting, sometimes without the United States, the greater proclivity to intervene has resulted in a dramatic reduction in civil war, genocide, and other forms of domestic politicide. Therefore, this post-Cold War, the U.S. sheriff duties are part of a general trend and a general arrangement which is largely successful. So Iraq, I would argue, is a tragedy. It's on all our minds, rightly and understandably so. Let it not detract you from the fact, from the larger fact, that global human security is improved, and it's improved in part as a result of an arrangement that has the United States acting as a part-time global sheriff. All right, fourth point. Alternatives to this arrangement are probably worse than this arrangement, but in any case, are impossible. So really, there's nothing to debate about, but because I'm a scholar by profession, I have to debate about it anyway, so I'll talk to you about it. You know, the U.S. is an unpopular sheriff, sometimes does unpopular things. This arrangement, it's the worst arrangement you can imagine except for the alternatives. I mean, the main alternative that people imagine is so-called multipolarity. That's a system where you have not one power that's looming up over the others, but where sheriff duties are shared among equally capable great powers. Well, the problem with this, in the first place, is it's not going to happen. There's no other state that's going to match the United States in U.S. economic, technological, military, economic power for a long time. And over that period, the only state that's going to be able to organize some of these activities on the scale of the U.S. is the U.S. But in a way, that sort of possibility issue hides a much more interesting one. That is that no other major power is really trying to match the United States. Their defense spending as a percentage of their economy is declining in most cases or holding steady. China, Russia, India, Japan, the EU, none of them is making the kind of investments that they would have to make if they were trying to catch up to the United States in these kinds of capabilities. Why? Well, for one thing, they know the United States doesn't really threaten them. And for another, as dissatisfied as they may be with the U.S. as its sheriff role, they're not dissatisfied enough to sacrifice other objectives, like economic growth and welfare, to purchase the military capabilities necessary to create a different system than the one we live in. So it's not happening. But even if it were to happen, I don't think it would be any better than what we have now. I think it would probably be worse. You realize you'd have a committee of great powers that would all share sheriff duties. You wouldn't just have in that committee, of course, you know, nice countries and easy to work with countries like other European countries. You'd have some countries that are fairly tough on their own regard. China would be a part of it. Russia would be a part of it. Arguably, Japan should be a part of it. India should be a part of it. I think with an arrangement like that, well, I guess we could save that for the question and answer. If you think an arrangement like that would be more efficient and more just than the current arrangement, we'll debate it in the Q&A. I don't think so. In any case, multipolarity kind of faces a problem in that it has an inherent contradiction, which is if all these other major powers build up their power to act as sheriffs, they're going to end up scaring each other, getting into their own arms races, and the world will be worse off. This is clearest in the case of the Asian triangle, the situation between India, China, and Japan, but it may even be the case elsewhere. If they don't build up their capabilities, then what you get is not a multipolar world, but what Neil Ferguson calls an apolar world, a world with no great powers inclined to act as sheriffs. In either case, I would argue the situation is worse than the one we have. All right, I'm running out of time. I've argued that the U.S. is not an outlaw. It's kind of a sheriff. That the sheriff system it's got going, with all of its faults, warts, and inadequacies, is actually improving global security, and that the alternatives are probably worse, and in any case, they're impossible. What's there left to say? Well, it's this, that the debate, in some sense, here, I think, over this whole sheriff question, is kind of behind the curve. That is, this debate about the United States as a rogue, outlaw, unilateral power is sparked, in large part, by the Bush administration's brief, with the stretch on brief, flirtation with neoconservative, neo-Wilsonian ideas, a flirtation that we associate with the name Paul Wolfowitz and the other neocons, the idea that we're going to bring democracy to the world on the back of American military power and solve decisively the problems the world faces through unilateral action. This phase, ladies and gentlemen, is over. The debate here often seems to think that the neoconservatives are still in full swing. It underestimates the fact that the U.S. conservative, the U.S. electorate, although I agree, it's more conservative than the European electorate. I admit it. The country is different in the sense that our voters are more conservative than your voters, but they're not stupid. When a president makes a massive strategic blunder, they make him pay for it. Bush's numbers now are lower than any other president in popularity polls at this stage of their tenure. he's getting hammered. There is nobody in the Republican Party right now saying, oh, gee, I want to inherit the foreign policy legacy of George Bush. I want to be just like George Bush. I want to bring our country into another quagmire. That's going to get me elected. They are running away from that legacy as fast as their patent leather shod feet can carry them. So the idea that somehow you've got a sheriff that it is imperfect, it makes terrible mistakes, but it can learn. And it is learning. Its very political processes are leading to that learning. So I think the debate we're having today over the U.S. is ironic in the sense that it's influenced by the Iraq experience, by the outrage over that, by the disagreement with that policy. But that very same experience, the Iraq experience, is pushing the United States away from the kinds of policies that are so unpopular. I think in the future, you will see a movement of the United States away from the extreme position that it occupied in 2003. And then, of course, my role in any future debate will be a lot easier. But then, of course, Mick will never call me for that debate. Thanks very much.
Well, like Bill, Mick, thanks very much indeed for inviting me. I have to just say one thing anecdotally. I was actually a student in London during the 1960s, which was a very good time to be a student in London. I had to admit that I was actually studying sciences over at that godless place, Imperial College in South Kensington. But we had quite a lot of student activity there, and I remember one occasion, I think it was 1965 or 66, when the Rhodesians under Ian Smith had declared UDI. And there was going to be a demo outside Rhodesia House, which at that time was just next to South Africa House at the far end of the Strand. And a group of about 300 or 400 of us turned up for this demonstration. We were more or less outnumbered by the police. And it was, you know, a little bit of a sorry affair. And people were getting quite disheartened. And then suddenly there was a kind of sound in the distance. And this sound developed into a kind of roar. We looked up the Strand, and there were about 3,000 LSE students taking over the whole of the Strand to come and actually run the demonstration. And it really got quite lively later in that afternoon. So in a sense, that was my first involvement with this institution, and I've had many since then. What I'd like to do, let me say at the first that obviously there's an artificiality between talking about sheriffs and outlaws. I don't believe as such that the United States is an outlaw state, but I think there are some very dangerous aspects of U.S. foreign and security policy which have developed in the last 5 or 6 years. And I think one area where I think I would disagree with Bill is while the neocon flush may be through, I think its long-term effects are actually going to be extremely dangerous. I don't think we are in remotely out of the woods, and I want to explore that a bit. In fact, what I'd like to do in the time allowed, and I'm clear, like you will be, that the key period will be the question and answer session, so 20 minutes absolutely strict. If I head beyond 7:15 on that clock, then Mick, please, for heaven's sake, shut me up. Essentially, what I'd like to do is just take us back over the last 4 or 5 years and particularly look at the current predicament and where that may lead in the future. I think, for a start, that in fact, the security of the Persian Gulf is going to be probably one of the two key international security issues for the next 30 years. And something has been set up there which is not going to go away. People talk very much about the idea of the United States needing an exit strategy from Iraq. What we're talking about, actually, is the evolution of entry strategy, not an exit strategy. I think people really do not appreciate the way things are going in that respect. Let's just go back briefly, just in sense as a reminder. Certainly, the neocon influence in U.S. politics, as some people called it, a very American coup, came to the fore in an extent, even though it had been developing for 20 or 30 years, came to the fore in the late 1990s, and you had the various groups, the Project for the New American Century and all the others. It had some very interesting parallels in many ways with a similar kind of period during Jimmy Carter's presidency. Some of you will remember it at the end of the 1970s. And then you had the various interest groups on the Republican right, like the Committee on the Present Danger, Heritage, and others, who were basically advocating that the United States had to face down the Soviet Union, that it was absolutely essential to do it. Reagan got in, many of the people in those interest groups actually came into significant positions of power, and you had what I think now we acknowledge was probably the most dangerous phase of the Cold War in the early 1980s. The parallel in the 1990s was that here, the Soviet Union had gone, if you like, apart from China, which is really a quite separate case, that kind of economic ideology had more or less disappeared in a puff of smoke, consigned to the dustbin of history. And now what seemed in real prospect was the idea of what was called at the time, and is still sometimes referred to as the New American Century, that in a sense, there was an almost messianic vision. This was always a small minority, of course, in American politics, so one always has to remember that. But I'm also really struck by the way that while that was coming to the fore, the other development, which basically IR people don't talk about much, was the rise of political influence of Christian Zionism in the United States. And in a sense, to some extent, you have this faith-based mixture with the neocon vision, which really was powerful and I think is still quite enduring. In terms of the vision, I still think that one of the best comments on that was by Charles Krauthammer, that regular columnist for the Weekly Standard, and somebody who I think has been one of the most interesting people to read on neoconservatism. And he takes the view, of course, and he put it this way. This is just 3 months before 9/11. Multipolarity, yes, when there is no alternative, but not when there is. Not when we have the unique imbalance of power that we enjoy today and that has given the international system a stability and essential tranquility that it has not known for at least a century. The international environment is far more likely to enjoy peace under a single hegemon. Moreover, we are not just any hegemon, we run a uniquely benign imperium. Now, essentially, I think 5 or 6 months into the Bush administration, things did seem to be going very well. And in a way, I think the 9/11 attacks, the atrocities, were rather like the runner in a race heading for the finishing line who is tripped up. A colleague of mine, Malcolm Dando, who I've worked with over the years, said to me just a couple of days after, he said, Paul, the real significance of 9/11 is it does mean the hawks will do what they want. And in a real way, sense, I think that was what happened. And in the, 3 or 4 months after 9/11, we had this change in European thinking. Le Monde, on the 12th of September, could say, we are all Americans now. But within 3 or 4 months, that had largely dissipated. Yes, the Taliban had gone. One regime had been terminated in Afghanistan. You had the State of the Union address in January 2002. The axis of evil was defined. And the West Point speech 3 months later, in which early preemption was seen as essential for US security. And even by then, into 2002, you had this unease among European governments, let alone populations, about the way things were going. It seemed that the sheriff and the outlaw were getting mixed up in some extraordinary way. Now, if we fast forward in a sense, it's worth actually looking at what has happened over the last 3 to 4 years since the 9/11 events, and in a sense, where we are now and what that actually means. If you take Afghanistan first, I think it's worth recalling that it was almost, it's pretty clear, I think, and many analysts now take this view, that essentially one of the aims of the 9/11 attacks indirectly was that the Al-Qaeda movement, I'll use the term movement, essentially hoped to attract the United States military into Afghanistan. They believed, in a sense, that if the United States military could come in a way almost like the Soviets of 20 years previously, then they would be really tied down in Afghanistan. The United States military did not make this mistake. A combination of very heavy bombing, using use of special operations troops, and in particular the rapid rearmament of the Northern Alliance, interestingly, mostly from Russian sources, which is somewhat ironic, if financed by the United States, meant that in a sense what happened towards the end of 2001 was the civil war, which was still ongoing in Afghanistan, was actually tipped in favor of the Northern Alliance, and the Taliban was terminated as a regime. But not defeated in the conventional sense. The evacuation of the Taliban militia from Kabul was one particular example, done virtually overnight. And our dear BBC friend John Simpson could claim to liberate the city the following morning. But essentially, there was this belief that this was one regime terminated, and that at least was one problem solved. I remember being in Washington 3 months after that, in March 2002, and talking to one of the people who had been in the Bush transition team. And this is at a time, you may remember, when there was already a lot of talk about the absolute imperative of actually terminating the regime of Saddam Hussein in Iraq. And I was speaking to this guy, and I said, look, do you not realize the difficulty you're going to face if you get into Iraq? And he looked at me in a rather withering way and said, for God's sake, Paul, you don't seem to understand. Doing Iraq right means we won't have to go for Iran. And essentially, that was the way it was seen at the time. Then, and I think still to some extent now, Iran is the greater problem. And it was believed that Iraq would be relatively easy to deal with. Incidentally, from what is now known about the war planning, the reason, in fact, that the war to terminate the Saddam Hussein regime did not take place for yet another year was basically for pure military reasons. So many of the specialist munitions had been used in Afghanistan, you had all the major arms companies working 24/7 for 10 months to rebuild stocks. It was not feasible for the US military to take on even the weakened Saddam Hussein regime until the early months of 2003. You move on to the Iraq and the termination of the regime. There were many warnings in the United States that this was highly dangerous and would lead to an aftermath which would be extremely bitter. But nevertheless, the termination went ahead, and initially it appeared to work to some extent. What we've now seen is the development of an insurgency, which I think now is seen to have implications which go very much beyond Iraq itself. And essentially, we've seen in the last, 2 years, 2.5 years, about 30,000 civilians killed, many tens of thousands injured. You have about 10, maybe 15,000 people detained without trial. And essentially, Iraq has become a focus for, to some extent, a revitalized, if much more disparate, al-Qaeda movement. Which brings me on, in fact, to the third point, the status of that movement, and if you like, that campaign. Now, essentially, I think what has happened, firstly, is the level of activity of paramilitary actions across the world has been much higher in the last 4 years since 9/11 than in the 4 years before. You just got to think of all the different attacks and all the activities, and indeed the many incidences which were prevented in one way or another. And essentially, as a movement, the al-Qaeda movement is probably a lot stronger with more recruits and more of an idea of where it is going in the longer term. And I think the problem here is that the idea of the war on terror, in even a crude way, being a sheriff action which is working, it is not actually working. And I think that is one of the key problems that is being faced at the present time. But I want to draw together the idea of this movement and also the position of Iraq in this. If you stand back a bit and say, well, all right, you have a movement, it may be quite amorphous, it may have actually gone through many different changes, it may not be a single concrete movement, it is more almost a kind of idea. Then what are the kinds of aims involved? Well, that is really reasonably clear, and if you look at many different analyses, they come to a broadly similar conclusion. Essentially, the aim of this movement is both comprised of short-term and long-term aspects. In the short term, obviously, the ending of military occupation by the neo-Christian crusader forces in the Middle East, put very straightforwardly. Very closely allied to that, the termination of the House of Saud as the unacceptable, corrupt, and elitist keeper of the two holy places. Beyond that, very strong opposition to the many elite pro-Western regimes in the Arab world. Beyond that, almost as a side issue, the Israeli-Palestinian question, which has been embraced by the al-Qaeda movement in the last 3 years, but was never historically something of great interest to it, for very clearly defined reasons. And it's something which is embarrassing to most Palestinians, quite rightly so. You have those as essentially short-term factors, and then there are the regional issues like southern Thailand and elsewhere. But in the long term, you have the idea of the re-establishment of some sort of khalifa, a caliphate, which initially would spread from the Islamic Middle East beyond, maybe over centuries to a wider world, perhaps even getting into southern Spain in due course. But essentially, I think the point here is that this links in with Iraq, because I think the situation there is actually one of much longer-term significance than is generally appreciated. And this is for two different reasons. One is US forces with British forces and with the Israelis up in northeast Kurdistan areas of Iraq are basically there, and they can be easily seen as an occupying force from outside. But more than that, what one has to appreciate is that if you talk in any way about the establishment of a caliphate, you will obviously go back to what was the only sustained caliphate in the history of Islam, which takes you back to the Abbasid caliphate from what, about 750 to about 1250. never one which was solidly across the modern-day Middle East, with Persian and other occupiers at different times, but it was also the period which certainly had the greatest flowering of Arab and Islamic architecture, mathematics, medicine, and the rest. Where was this centered? Baghdad. So essentially you have the historic center of the most notable Khalifa, which is actually now can be said to be occupied by neo-Christian forces with their Zionist allies. And what you also have to factor into this is the huge changes in communications over the last 20 years. I think in particular the development of 24-hour satellite news channels located in the Middle East, Al Arabiya and Al Jazeera. I was struck very much, and in some ways I think it almost brings it down, by just some of the coverage of one particular part of the war in Iraq over the last 2.5 years, and that was the siege and the overrunning of Fallujah in November of last year. That was, from the Bush administration's perspective, done immediately after re-election. It was believed that Fallujah was very much the center of the insurgency. Reporters were embedded with the US troops, and what you had was very strong force being used, with abundant television force pictures of it being used. You remember the pictures of all the tracer ordnance and the rest going towards the city from outside across the river. Now, in a sense, that really demonstrated that there was a very strong power which possibly could put down the insurgency. Turn the whole thing round and put it in with the reports coming from within Fallujah on Al Jazeera and elsewhere, and what you had was the city of mosques assaulted from outside by an illicit occupying force. In other words, turn the whole thing round from a different angle, you see it from a very different perspective. And essentially, these two different views are going to be incredibly difficult to in any sense bring together. And I think one of the reasons why the Al-Qaeda movement is actually having a degree of success which may lead to a whole range of other forms of violence is because of the nature of the situation that you have in Iraq. Now, therefore, you might turn around and say, well, all right, this is a mess. Everybody acknowledges it's a mess. Therefore, in due course, over the next year or two, the United States will actually start to withdraw. And this, of course, brings us into the final factor which I want to touch on, the hoary old thing about the geopolitical significance of the wider Persian Gulf. Now, I'm not one of these people who say the Iraq war, the occupation of Iraq, was actually designed to increase the power base and the wealth of American oil companies. May well do that eventually, certainly not doing it at the present time. Neither am I one of these people who says it was all about controlling Iraqi oil. It's true that if the United States has a client regime in Baghdad, it basically has influence over oil reserves which are 5 times those of the entire continental United States, including Alaska. It's not about that. What it is about is long-term trends. And what one has to appreciate is that there's been a long trend in US military thinking about the crucial importance of the Gulf energy resources. You can actually date the day at which this really became forceful to October the 17th, 1973, when the Arab members of OPEC put the price of oil up hugely at the time of the Yom Kippur Ramadan war, and we had the first of the huge oil price shocks. It's worth remembering that we talk now about oil going up from $30 to $60 a barrel, a doubling in the price. In the 6 months after the Yom Kippur War, it went up by 450%. That was the first big shock. And since then, with the Rapid Deployment Force, Central Command, and the rest, you've actually had the Gulf as far more significant as far as US energy security policy is concerned. But it's the future which is significant less than the past. Because what is now happening with 2/3 of all the world's oil reserves in a very narrow zone around the Gulf, whoever essentially has, if you like, the lead role, the most security control of that region, is going to be massively significant over the next 20, 30, or 40 years. The United States currently imports about 55% of its oil. It's going up to close to 70% by 2020. Only 10 years ago, China was self-sufficient in oil. Now it is about 25% import dependent, and that is rising rapidly year by year, far faster than the rate in which the United States is dependent. Note in particular how China has done these very massive deals with Iran in the past year for 20-year supplies of oil and natural gas. So the bottom line here is that I do not see an exit strategy for the United States from Iraq in the near or even in the longer-term future. I should say I hope I'm wrong on this, But I will be very surprised if there are not major U.S. bases in Iraq in 10 years' time, the ones that are now being built, the permanent ones which are now currently being built. So where we're left, essentially, and I've got 2 minutes, I will draw it to a close here, where we're left is essentially an extremely difficult and potentially long-term dangerous security predicament. And on the one hand, you have a rather amorphous but really quite strong, a potentially very violent movement, which actually is bitterly resentful and building on that resentment of what is seen to be a foreign occupation of a key region of the Islamic world. On the other hand, you actually have in the United States, within the heartland of the Pentagon and elsewhere, an absolute realization of the importance of the Persian Gulf and in the importance of Iraq. If the United States was to withdraw from Iraq, I have no hesitation in saying it would be the biggest single foreign policy reversal in the past 60 years. And I do not think it will happen. Which brings me to the final point, what about sheriff or outlaw? I think the problem is that under the influence in the very early part of this new century, the first 2 or 3 years of neoconservative thinking, the United States went badly wrong in its international security policy. The way it reacted to the atrocities, the grotesque atrocities of 9/11, has actually set in motion very dangerous circumstances in the long term. In that defined period, it behaved to an extent in an outlawish way. But the problem here, and I think this is where Bill and I really will differ, is I think that these other forces mean that that is set in motion, dangerous for the much longer term. And getting out of that predicament, I think, is going to be extremely difficult. It will require a very major change in long-term US security thinking. It will require a very major change, I think, in the attitudes of Europeans. But at root, it will depend on whether within the United States a political view of almost a mission to actually have a world which, to an extent, is in the American image, whether that does actually survive. I remember going back to my student days, I did actually have a friend at LSE from Ghana, and he basically, one day he reminded me of Victorian Britain and its imperial functions. And he said, you know, Paul, there's a very good reason why the sun never set on the British Empire. I said, what's that? He said, well, it's because God didn't trust the British in the dark. And essentially, this is the bottom line. I think we, most academics in international relations, are basically from the Atlantic community. And we tend to forget about the majority world. 96% of the world's population are not Americans. 99% aren't British, I should add. But essentially, I think what we are not seeing clearly is the global security dynamic. I would agree with Bill in one sense, in that one has to look to what can replace the situation we're in at the present time. What I do think is that we are in dangerous times, and to relive that Chinese curse, I think we're going to be cursed for a little while longer. Thank you.
This is for Paul. This is for Paul. I agree with many of your comments, and just on the fact that you think the Persian Gulf is going to be incredibly important for oil, and the American dependence, particularly military dependence on oil, what would you suggest they do, seeing as if they'd still like to be a major power in the next 40 years? What do you suggest they do, other than try and retain a hold over Persian oil?
I think it's actually part of a much wider problem, because oil is one part of a much bigger global problem. I did actually say at one stage that I thought the Persian Gulf security issue would be one of the two key issues for the next 30 years. The other issue, which is actually much more important, is climate change, much more important in the longer term. And as we're now starting to appreciate that climate change, unlike what the modelers thought 10 years ago, is going to have a huge effect on the tropical land masses, leading to a drying out of those land masses. If we don't reverse that, then essentially all bets are off in terms of the nature of international insecurity in 30 years' time. There is time to reverse it. So I would say, actually, that it's not just a problem for the United States. It's a problem for all of the industrialized and industrializing world. What we need is a pretty rapid move away from oil-based and fossil fuel-based economies. Now, that, I think, is necessary for quite different reasons, these wider climate change reasons. But essentially, that actually factors in to this particular area. There are two separate reasons why you should move away from oil dominance. One is the global issue of climate change. Two is the current location and the insecurity that comes in its wake. So I would actually look to radical changes in the whole pattern of industrial development and the huge fossil fuel dependency we have at present. That is the big issue for the next 30 years.
Bill, do you want to say anything about either fossil fuels or Kyoto? No? Right. I heard a US congressman last night telling me that global warming didn't exist, so there you go. So
could I just come in on that, Mick?
Yeah.
My wife and I have run a small holding in the Pennines in East Yorkshire for the last 35 years. 5 years ago, I planted in the open air on a south-facing slope a vineyard, and it's doing quite well. I couldn't have done that 20 years ago, so believe me, climate change is happening.
And that's Yorkshire, by the way.
That's Yorkshire, yes.
Well, let me come in on that with one small comment, and that is that the reason I didn't comment before is because I want to make this an exciting meeting, and I want to disagree with Paul. But as a card-carrying member of the academic establishment, I, of course, agree we should reduce our dependence on oil and get rid of all these horrible SUVs and have confiscatory taxes on wasteful energy use. But that said...
It's always the most important word in the English language.
I don't discount the importance of global warming. I don't discount the importance of the security problems in the Persian Gulf. But let's not forget that in the Cold War, we had the Persian Gulf problem. We prepared for war in the Persian Gulf. At the same time as we were preparing for global thermonuclear war against the Soviet Union that had 27,000 nuclear weapons pointed at us. We were thinking about a downside risk in the Cold War of the destruction of human civilization, not over decades, not over centuries, but in minutes. And at the same time, the U.S. lost 87,000 soldiers killed and probably itself killed over 2 million people in wars in Asia, fought to maintain its reputation for prestige in the Cold War. I'm concerned about security issues today. They're serious. But let's keep it in perspective. The overall security situation in the world now is immeasurably better than it was 15 years ago.
Thanks, Bill. Great. There's a question up there, yeah, and did I have another one over here. I'll take a couple more from the top. I'll take a couple together as long as they're not too long. Yeah, go for it.
Thank you very much. My name is Eugene Colgan. I'm a master's candidate here. This debate between two distinguished realists was very fascinating to witness, but I hope I'm not going to be lynched for this. I would like to bring in some other things into the discussion, like the title of the talk is American Power, Global Sheriff or International Outlaw. You've tended to focus on the second half of it. Now, American power is more, there's more to American power than just military force, isn't there? I mean, there is economic power, cultural influence, technological, educational. Could you perhaps reflect briefly on the role of those aspects of U.S. power in fighting and hopefully winning the war on terror? Thanks.
I'll take another question up there. Yeah, anybody. Just you.
Hello. I think the US government does believe in international law rather in the same way, I think, as a Wild West sheriff believes in the rule of law, which is to say that it should be brought about, but it needs certain preconditions in the kinds of people or states it's being applied to before it is. And if you apply a sort of by-the-book rule of law to states that are the equivalent of Liberty Valance, to continue the Wild West analogy, then it's simply not going to work. Dealing with states like Iran or North Korea, I think the point of view of even Americans who do believe in international law is that if you do it by the book, something terrible is going to go wrong. But if you sort them out, if you apply a stern unilateral policy that might bring about a more liberal democratic society by whatever means in that part of the world, then maybe the rule of law can work after that point, but certainly not before. Your thoughts on that?
You thought these two guys are realists. Okay, Bill, do you want to have a go?
Yeah, very quickly on power, absolutely important not to reduce power of a country to military power, but I think it's also very important not to be overly reactive to events. The current trends in thinking about relative U.S. power have taken a dramatic turn in response to learning that it's hard to fight and defeat an insurgency.
Well, I think that the fact that it's hard to fight and defeat an insurgency is nothing new. It's something that's been out there for a long time. It's something my government should have known about before it got us into Iraq. But it's not something that changes the fundamental wellsprings of American power, which include technological, they include economic, they include scientific and educational. And yes, they include very, very long, decades-long investments in military infrastructure. Those things aren't going to change soon. They're going to be there for a long time. So I think that it's the combination of the various underlying factors that puts the U.S. in this position, or at least makes the U.S. in the position to assume this position of some kind of qualified sheriff. On the second question, U.S. attitude towards international law, well, that's true, but it's more complicated than that in the sense that even the laws of the Wild West, if you could find them in a book, were much less ambiguous than international law, particularly international law on the question of intervention. International law is very clear on some things. But as you move from things like consular issues and clearly signed treaties out to the place where you're talking about military intervention, you have two principles in conflict, state sovereignty and self-defense, and now you have the new principle of humanitarian intervention, humanitarian prevention of genocide. So you put those three issues all in play, you can't have clarity, which means that to say that something is consistent or not consistent with a set of rules that's fundamentally ambiguous is a meaningless statement.
Right. Don't sit on the fence, Bill.
No, I won't sit on the fence. But I want
Paul,
to,
what about you?
Yeah, I want to go back to the first question, this question of other forms of power. And I don't want to consider it just in terms of U.S. power. I'd like to consider it more in terms of elite power. I think one of the most significant trends of the last 30 years, and it's one which I think is still largely unrecognized, is that while we've been in a period of pretty sustained economic growth, it's been highly variable in different parts of the world, what has actually happened is that if you take the global population currently of about 6 billion, about 1.2 billion are actually doing extremely well, a sort of a trans-global elite, which can involve maybe 100 million people in India or 150 million people in China out of a billion in each of those countries, and may involve the majority of the population of countries like Britain. But the curious thing is, the other 5 billion, the difference between that 1 billion and the other 5 is actually widening. It's been widening for the last 20 or 30 years. And in fact, there are far more people, not in abject poverty, but relatively marginalized and relatively on the margins. And demographically, they tend to be younger people as well. In concert with that, you've had huge improvements in communications, in literacy, and primary level education. And what has happened essentially is that what you might call the majority marginalized are aware of the marginalization. And essentially, the way the economic system works, and this is not just to blame the United States, you could take in the EU, you could take in elites in other countries, is a system which actually benefits the minority and is doing so with steadily greater intensity. Now, the reaction to that can take the form of radical social movements. It can take the form of high levels of criminality in major cities. And it is unpredictable. To some extent, aspects of the Al-Qaeda movement are part of this reaction. The Maoist, quasi-Maoist revolution in Nepal is very clearly part of it. But at the bottom line, you actually had to focus on two different approaches. One is essentially maintaining the status quo, what I've called elsewhere lidism, keeping the lid on things. And the other is basically looking at the core issues and the longer-term drivers of conflict. Now, I actually agree with Bill about the huge dangers of the Cold War years. We know far more about how dangerous that period was. And in a real sense, there's a small risk of all-out global catastrophe. I think we're in a different era now, a kind of slippery slope, which is in some ways more difficult to comprehend and to counter. And in its own way, climate change may be at that sort of level in 30 or 40 years' time. But the key point I'm saying is that it's no good just looking at it in terms of US power. What I think is the paradigm is wrong. We are not appreciating in the Atlantic communities the kind of world which is actually existing globally and one which is much more clearly seen in the majority world. I would guess that probably everybody present in this room, or almost everybody, is part of the global elite. Probably. And I think the point is that that is largely unrecognized, and the risk is that if you get this combination of knowledge and disempowerment, you get what we call the revolution of frustrated expectations. And it might just be that in a curious way, in one particular sphere, Al-Qaeda is more significant as a symptom of future trends rather than an entity in its own right.
Thanks very much, yeah. There was a question. Did you have the... Have you got your... Come on, guys, with the mics. Let's get you going. There's one there, there's one up there, and there's a guy over there in the blue shirt. I'll take three, actually, please, yeah.
Okay. Sebastian, MSc student. I wanted to bring the attention back to Europe, which is maybe a bit strange, but it's in my opinion, linked to the U.S. So because, first of all, it's Europe has the same strategic outlook as the U.S., especially in Persian Gulf, because Europe is even more depending on Persian or Iraq or Saudi Arabian oil in the last years, and will be even increasingly depending on this oil, energy-wise, resource-wise. Secondly, it's especially with Iran and Iraq, it's the close neighborhood of Europe. It's not the close neighborhood of the U.S. If you talk of proliferation or mass weapons of mass destruction. The third thing is that in the 15 years after the ending of the Cold War, every time when we had a EU-US partnership, it wasn't an end kind of success. If you look at Bosnia or Kosovo or something like this, Iraq was not a success, in parts also because it was not an EU-US partnership. So the question is now to both of you in a different angle. If we have, what's the in the next years, if the new conservative moment is moving away, what's the possibility of the EU or Europe to gain more attention in D.C. again, in Washington, in the U.S.? What's the possibility that that the government or future governments are coming back to a more partnership with the EU?
Right, okay. I'll hold that one, Bill.
Hello.
Please, yeah.
Hi, Louisa Sunderman, a PhD candidate here at the LC. My question is actually specifically for Professor Woolforth. I'm just over here.
I beg your pardon.
I was wondering if you could comment. The anthropologist Julian Pitt Rivers distinguishes between honor felt, honor claimed, and honor paid. I was wondering if we should be interpreting your introduction and conclusion as a suggestion that the United States feels that honor has not been paid. And the other comment is quickly just that I can't help but noticing the contrast between your position on the U.S. role in the global sphere with that was recently suggested by the UN, the U.S. representative to the UN, John Bolton, at Chatham House recently. He seemed to be denying a role of leadership.
Do you want to speak for John Bolton or leave?
Yeah.
It was a fine speech, too. One of his best.
Ioannis Glinavos, University of Kent. I'd like to ask, how is it possible that the U.S. is not an outlaw when it's breaching international human rights obligations in Guantanamo and in Iraq?
Okay, we've got three questions then. One on Europe, one on honor, and one on human rights and therefore the United States. It's got to be an international outlaw. Bill, do you want to kick off?
I'll go quickly. I'll go quickly in the interest of having more discussion, not in any sense as a commentary on the questions, so I'll deserve 20 minutes apiece. On the U.S.-EU partnership, it's already happening, except there's one problem. That is to say, what you asked is already happening. The American government is trying to do a better job working with the Europeans. It's trying to do it on Iran. The problem is twofold. One is Bush, our president, can't fire anybody. And so you mentioned John Bolton. I mean, you know, the idea of getting rid of Bolton is to put him in charge of our delegation to the UN. And Rumsfeld is still there. And a man who is incapable of firing people has a hard time changing policy. And so you're seeing less change than ought to be, and indeed less change than is being demanded, because of the stubbornness of a single man who happens to occupy the White House, and that is an unfortunate reality. Therefore, I predict that the impetus towards trying to work closer with the Europeans will only increase once we have a change of government. We might even be a greater emphasis after the midterm elections for Congress, which could hurt the Republicans unless the numbers start changing pretty quickly. They're not going to do well in the midterm. It's going to be a great embarrassment. Secondly, honor. No, I meant the beginning and the ending comments just to be joking with Mick. Absolutely. It's clear that, I mean, I don't want to talk too long, but the thing is that the Iraq situation is a hellish situation on many angles. And I think that it is, what I was trying to get at was that it is a situation that draws attention to questions like this. but that draws attention away from the larger trends. And as a social scientist, we're in a school of social science. I feel so comfortable here. Mm. I love it. No humanists around, you know. No scientists. All social scientists.
You look at the larger trends.
You look at the larger trends when you ask questions like this, and of course, always you always think of what are the feasible alternatives to the situation as it exists. So that's what I was trying to get at with that. Mm. And finally, with the breaches of international law, the United States has chosen a tendentious interpretation of international law. I mean, the question of whether Geneva Convention applies to people who are not the agents of a state is a question that is not consistently answered in international conventions that exist. Now, there's a group of people who think that the international conventions as they exist should be applied this way, and there's a group of people who think we should revise them so that they apply this way, and there's a group of people in the United States who think they just don't apply. It's you can't, in a situation of that kind of ambiguity, say this is clearly an outlaw. And I should say, by the way, that what the United States is doing in terms of trampling on legal precedents is far more problematic in the domestic context, because what they're doing is they can seize anyone, including an American citizen, say that he's suspected of being a terrorist, and they've already done this to an American citizen, and deny that person any kind of due process. We have to take the word of the President of the United States that they have evidence that this person's a terrorist. Well, come on. I mean, that's just not credible. And so there is a kind of a very, very strong reaction to this going on in the United States today. But fundamentally, when it comes to the international law, when you have three or four principles in conflict, it's very, very difficult to determine that someone is in breach of an understood convention.
If I could just go to that one and also to the first one on Euro-American relations. On the last issue, I don't like to use the term outlaw or outlawish myself. I think it's quite clear that there are massive problems with a series of US actions in Guantanamo and the use of torture and the rest. But I'm bound to say that the United States is no way alone on this at present. We have this appeal going through the British legal system at present as to whether it's acceptable for evidence gained by torture to be used in a British court of law. Britain has been very much a party to the process of rendition, of taking people through to countries which use torture for purposes of getting many more information. So yes, high criticism of the United States, but they are not alone on that. And in a sense, I don't want to be rather sort of a bit of a wet blanket, but when you look at Euro-American relations, I'm not at all sure that I think the Europeans are that much better in their approach to problems of international security at the present time. And in terms of that wider issue that I raised, the whole question of lidism in terms of maintaining the world system as it is, the Europeans are just as much involved in this. And Glen Eagles and debt and climate change and aid notwithstanding, very little really came out of that G8 meeting. I do not see the kind of change in attitude which is actually going to produce real progress towards sustainable international development yet. And I would hold the Europeans just as much responsible for that as the United States. I wish it was different, and my fear, in a sense, that if there is more of a rapprochement and more of a closer working relationship, that will still be the minority world doing its best to maintain control of the majority world in all the different ways in which this has been done for the last 50 years or so.
There's a question at the back there. There was a question in the middle. There was somebody down here who had a hand up. Yeah. Okay, we'll take this one up. Yeah, please.
My name is Mike. I'm a master's student here at the school. I enjoyed sort of the idea that the United States is sort of a thoughtful citizen, a thoughtful world citizen, and debates about certain tense debates about international law, conventions, these sorts of things about security. But I think there are some examples where very clear international law is being, not followed. And I'm thinking about NAFTA right now, and there's a big debate in Canada, the United States, about softwood lumber, and most trade tribunals have ruled in favor of Canada, and yet the United States sort of just decides that it's not really interested in following the decisions of these trade tribunals. So I want to sort of ask you about more clear breaches of international law. How do you feel about that?
Okay, who's over here? Yeah, please.
Hi. I just would like to have a look at the title. It says American Power, Global Sheriff. That a sheriff is somebody who is elected by the general people, in this case the world, to look out for problems. But America, when they invaded Iraq, went against the UN, and a lot of people in their country, you said, Professor Wolfoff said they got hammered after Bush got hammered after he went to Iraq, and he was getting hammered before I went to demonstrations in London, and there were demonstrations in America. How can Bush, how can Bush or America be a sheriff if they're not actually being backed by the rest of the world?
Okay, I'll take those two anyway. Bill, do you want to pick up on that? Second one first.
Yeah, very quickly. whenever you give a talk like this, you live in mortal fear. Somebody will ask a question about something you don't know a bloody thing about.
it's never stopped you answering.
Never stopped. But when it comes to the U.S. Canadian lumber imbroglio, for me to pronounce upon this would be an act of hubris. And I fully take the point that when it comes to that issue, perhaps the U.S. is indeed on that particular issue acting in an outlawish way. I will say there are plenty of examples, however, of after kicking and screaming and putting on a show, often for domestic audiences, that you have to let it become a big enough issue and pretend that you've really fought hard, that ultimately the U.S., on many of these WTO disputes that are submitted to tribunal, has in fact ultimately given in. And the game you're seeing there is less an outlaw game than a game of politics. It's showing the steel people that you tried. It's pathetic, it's hopeless, but frankly, it's ubiquitous in politics. The second thing is, this is international politics. That's why the sheriff isn't elected. And in the case of the... we could talk about it in a domestic context, but we're talking about international relations. However, you make a legitimate point that the United States had a theory of how to lead, and that theory went under the name of the new unilateralism, and it was, we go in, we succeed, we make a new reality, and the rest of the world will come along. Well, I have to tell you, if they'd gone in there, if they found the WMD, they found the nuclear programs they said were there, if they'd cleaned it all up, left a beautiful democracy in return when they left, I bet everybody would have said, well, that was a nice piece of international leadership. But that's about as likely to happen as for me, to fly to the moon now. So it was a flawed idea of leadership. They had it right in the sense that, in fact, in reality, whatever persuasion you are of international relations theory, the fact of the matter is if a powerful state creates a public good through an action that was originally unpopular, if it creates a public good, ultimately, the international community will come around and say that it was a good idea or a good thing, or they'll accommodate to it. But in Iraq, I'm afraid, and here I don't disagree with my colleague, they created a public bad. So, of course, what you've got is the rest of the world community running away from it as fast as they can, which is something they can afford to do precisely because they know the United States is going to have to, one way or another, clean the thing up.
Paul. Just two brief comments on the trade issue, the one particular example of Canadian lumber. Again, this is part of a much wider issue which goes beyond the United States. And essentially, even with the WTO, the way in which trade rules work and have worked really for some decades generally favours the more powerful states, the more powerful trading partners, with some very rare exceptions. I don't actually see that has changed very much. I don't think the WTO is making very much difference. And it is part of the problem that we face, why we are getting these very deep differences, this very deep socioeconomic divide. On the question of, Lakshya just touched on this issue of the promotion of democracy in the Middle East. I have a huge problem with the idea of the Bush administration promoting democracy in the Middle East, frankly. I think that you could say the idea of democracy in the Middle East goes out the window faster than you can say the words Turkish Parliament. You remember the Turkish Parliament's attitude to American troops going in through northern Iraq. The reality is that if you had a democratic transformation in the Middle East, the United States would have no part in the Middle East. And that is something which is just not acceptable.
Okay, we've got one final round of questions, then we're going to conclude. Who's to go first? Who's where? Yeah, I'm the back there. Move, yeah, please.
I'm Heather. I'm a master's student here. Professor,
how many master's students do we have in this university?
Well, oh,
quite a number. A lot of them are American.
Yeah.
You made a comment at the end of your talk on kind of how we don't really need to make the Iraq issue the only issue of America being the international outlaw because the Vulcans have fallen, for lack of a better term. And so, we're not going to get into another quagmire war. My guess is the same arguments were put forth in the 70s after the fall of Saigon. We have seen that American governments and other governments have certainly not necessarily learned from past mistakes. So how I question your optimism that the cowboy nature of American power is necessarily going to fall more to the sheriff than to the outlaw if we cannot learn those mistakes that you are optimistic that the fall of the neocons will mean more, going back to more benevolent hegemon.
Right, okay. I didn't include the word cowboy in the title, but anyway. There's one here. Yeah, please. Don't like say you're a master's student.
I am a master's student.
Oh, my God.
I'm afraid. I'd like to follow on from that question and basically ask how likely you think an American attack on Iran is would be, and what the consequences of that would be.
If it were to happen. Okay. There's a person up there. Please.
Hello. Sorry, I was just wondering. I, too, am a master's student. I was just wondering, seeing as this is the Cold War Studies Center, what you both think about Russia's recent actions, talking about Iran and Condi getting flown up there quite quickly to talk about. I mean, I think that adds a very interesting security dynamic to the whole situation in the region.
Okay, I'm going to take the one last question here, please. Yeah. You have to speak up, please. Yeah, turn it on. I think, is it turned on? I don't know.
Okay, I have a question about the use of the term public bad. I would argue that it's almost too early to determine that Iraq is a public bad, because if we see the signs coming out of there with the election and the constitution, these are definite positive signs. And if we've seen from the past from Japan and the Marshall Plan, change doesn't occur within 2 years. It takes, you know, a process. So in your opinion, do you think it's a little too early to determine Iraq as a public bad?
Okay, there's quite a lot of people taking up. Whichever way you want to go.
I'll do the Iraq and the Iran ones, okay, if I may. On the Iraq side, well, if you look back over the last 2.5 years, Bush made his mission accomplished speech on the deck of the USS Abraham Lincoln on the 1st of May 2003, and then it was mission accomplished. 2 months later in July, Uday and Qusay Hussein were killed, and it was assumed the insurgency was over. In October 2003, we were told that the insurgency was down to a few extended families and they were coming under control. They weren't. Saddam Hussein was detained in December 2003. We were told the insurgency was going to come to an end. It didn't. In June 2004, Bremer gave up. You had the interim administration, ended the insurgency. It didn't happen. November 2004, Fallujah, that would knock the insurgency into a cocked hat. It didn't happen. The elections in January of this year, that would really see real progress. And now these recent elections, it isn't happening. It's actually getting worse, not better. And the problem is that on top of this, I wish it was different, I wish I could agree with you, but on top of this, what is not really appreciated widely is that Iraq is an absolute gift to the Al-Qaeda type of paramilitarism, because what it has produced is an extraordinary training ground for new generations of jihadists. It's replaced Afghanistan already. I mean, one of the most ironic things of the last 6 months was reports that young Afghan paramilitaries were going from Afghanistan to Iraq to get combat training to take back to Afghanistan for use against US troops. So what has been set up is a long-term focus for new generations of well-trained jihadists. I wish it was other, but it is not, and I do not see an early end to that insurgency. On the question of Iran, incredibly difficult to predict. I was in Tehran earlier this year, and I talked to a wide range of people about the perception from within Iran and what you might call a reasonably mainstream rather than theocratic perception. What I think one has to understand is that in addition to the obvious Iranian perception of a long-term sense of several thousand years of history, there is this belief that Iran has been declared as part of the axis of evil, that the United States has said that the regime must be terminated, that the Fifth Fleet controls the Persian Gulf and the Arabian Sea, that there are US forces in Afghanistan to the east and large forces to the west, that two neighboring countries, Afghanistan and Iraq, have already had the regimes terminated. And the feeling within Iran is, what the hell would you do? Would you not get nuclear weapons? So essentially, from their perception, whatever they do, I don't know, but they are under a very strong pressure from their own general population to take this step. But the other side of the coin is, this is completely unacceptable, both through Israel and the United States. It's going to be incredibly difficult to resolve it, and I'm not sure how it's going to be resolved. But I think there is a risk, not in the near future, but there is a risk over the next 2 to 3 years of some sort of an extension of conflict to Iran. And I think it's one of the areas we have to work incredibly hard to avoid, because the consequences would probably be even worse than the intervention in Iraq.
Well, very quickly, again, with the same proviso I mentioned before about moving forward, not because of the questions, which each could have a a whole conference devoted to them. The where have all the flowers gone question. When will they ever learn? Well, look.
That's one way of reframing the question.
This you just heard Paul go through a retinue of failed predictions about Iraq and how the insurgency would be beaten, which anyone who knows anything about the history of insurgencies, each one of which was ridiculous. However, let's go back through the retinue of things that were said and predicted prior to Afghanistan. The U.S. would meet its death in Afghanistan. Al-Qaeda would be a gift to Al-Qaeda. It would be another. What would happen to the United States was what happened to the Soviet Union. We'd need 500,000 troops, according to the U.S. military expert John Mearsheimer. We have to get ready for 25,000 casualties in Afghanistan. These guys paid as much attention to the pre-Afghanistan warning as they paid to the pre-Iran warning, to pre-Iraq warning. And in the case of Afghanistan, they were basically right. So what you have explained, the hubris you have going into Iraq is a result of people who were on a roll. They were on a little bit of a roll. And so that roll is, so to ask yourself, when will they unlearn the lessons of Iraq? When will they unlearn them? It'll be the next time you see them on a long, long roll of success and defying predictions. And I think on the question of insurgencies, that's not going to happen anytime soon. Second question, Iran. There are no good military options on Iran, according to the Pentagon itself. There are no good military options on Iran. There's no quick strike option. And there's certainly no occupation of a country that's mountainous with 70 million people and a highly nationalistic population. This is absolutely not going to happen.
That will do it.
The third question is Russia. Vladimir Putin assured us several years ago that the proliferation risk with respect to the Iranians was unfounded and was based on commercial concerns. We wanted to take away the nuclear business. Well, the IEA proved, and Mohammad al-Baradei proved Putin wrong. And the question is, you know, do you believe him this time? I'm not so sure I do. And finally, on the public bad question, well, Paul answered that. What I meant with public bad is that in terms of the war on terror, it's very hard to make the case that the invasion of Iraq has helped matters. In terms of the welfare of the Iraqi people, for a brutal dictator that was relatively stable with focused, horrific violence versus an insurgency that is killing people indiscriminately, I am not capable of judging that question. I think in the long run, likely the public for the Iraq as a collection of people, arguably, in the long run, they might be better off. Arguably, maybe 30 years from now, this invasion might have kicked off some historical trigger of events that's positive. But right now, it's a public bad.
Can I conclude by asking you both one question? I want to take you forward to November 2008.
Oh, geez.
Okay. There's been there's recently been an American election. There's a new president sitting in the Oval Office, and Professor Paul Rogers and Professor Bill Walforth are called in, and the president wants one piece of advice. What would you say to her? I think you better answer that one first, Paul.
Yeah, thanks. I had this fear you're going to say, what would you say to President Jeb? But that does seem to be the same.
I'm an optimist.
You're an optimist, yeah, right. I suppose if there's one thing to say, I would go back to this twin issue of Iraq and long-term climate change, that if the biggest thing that the United States could do would be to rethink its security predicament in the Gulf at the same time that it starts the real steps to help other countries and itself lead away from fossil fuel dependency. Right. That seems a rather hack thing to say in an international relations group, but essentially I'm one of these people who actually believe this is a much more important issue than is normally given credit for in IR.
And Bill, what would you say to her?
Well, why not end on a harmonious
All
note?
All right.
I didn't ask you to be harmonious.
What you need for that strategy is you need a Karl Rove kind of brutal political apparatchik who's going to put you together the coalition to support a different energy policy. And that, in fact, in terms of, if you do an economic analysis of the economic and regional and sectoral interests that would benefit under this policy, you could easily make the case that you can put together a better material coalition for an energy conservation policy than the current one. It's just a question of putting together. Who do you need to put it together? Machiavelli by another name. That's what it will take. It would be really, really, really tough, and you have to make a lot of compromises, but that's probably what I'd push her towards considering doing.
Well, I hope Hillary listens to your advice. Anyway, I just want to say, firstly, thank you to all of you for turning up and asking some great questions. Let me just also make a quick announcement for the future. On Tuesday, 8th of November, we're holding another debate. We have two former Congress people and Phil Davis from the American Studies Institute at the British Library, who'll be talking about Bush 2, Year 1, Lame Duck or Radical Reformer. I'm not quite sure what that title means, but I made it up sometime between the first and the second bottle of good red wine. It leaves no more just to say thanks to our two great speakers tonight for stimulating a great discussion.
Thank you very much for that. I really like that. That's good. Thank you very much. Thank you.